I'm really happy to see all of you and that you felt that you had the time and that it was a good idea to get together today. I'm here at Swami's invitation in India to explore, you know, the next phase of my own life, which is probably going to be traveling a lot more. I won't say teaching more because I've been doing that for a long time, but just in different places, doing different kind of work slightly. So it's been, even though I've really just started here, it's already been a different kind of adventure for me because I have nothing else to do except just meet with people and then talk about the spiritual path and then go away for a little while, then come back and do it again. And I don't have any community to run or anything else to do. And it's been very already, it's focused my consciousness in a way that I can see is what I should have been doing all along, but it's easier to do when circumstances change sometimes. That's why sometimes we do change our situations, because what's right in front of our face we can't see because we've been looking at the same scenery for so long. I'm sure you've seen those puzzles, you know, where there's a picture but you can't see the picture unless you stare at it for a long time and all of a sudden it comes out of all the patterns and so on. Well, life is like that. It's even, I think perhaps the word is more embarrassing, if you articulate the teachings all the time. And then suddenly very simple facts become obvious to you and one sees how much farther one has to go. In actual fact, that is what makes this spiritual path, at least to my experience, so extraordinarily rich. I did come to meet Swamiji when I was only 22, so you can't say I had a whole lot of life experience to compare pre-Ananda and post-Ananda. Pre-Ananda to me was just barely, as they say, getting out of short pants into long pants. That's just about all that I feel I did. And I often say that I grew up at Ananda, since there are whole generations of adults who literally grew up at Ananda. It's a little hard to sort of figure out how that works, but I felt like I was a child when I arrived, and what little I've learned about life, I learned once I got there. But prior to the time I came there, I'd run through a number of life experiences that were supposed to last longer than they did, but like college and relationships and certain ambitions and ideals, you just got to the end of them because the end of them was too contracted for the force that I had within me that I felt I needed to express. The boxes were too small. Before I met Swamiji, I really didn't know what I was going to do. And I was quite quietly hysterical about that thought. I mean, I've shared with some of you that sometimes I seriously considered having a nervous breakdown. That seemed like what to do. I thought you either become a drug addict, you commit suicide, or you have a nervous breakdown. Because what else do you do with your life energy with the options that were shown to me? That was just my karma. I think I've had a nervous breakdown a lot in other previous incarnations because it looked real familiar to me. I kind of almost could tell what it would be like. First, there would be a lot of drama. Everybody would get real excited. They'd all rush. They'd help me. They'd take me off to an institution. They'd work on me for a while. Gradually, I'd get better. They'd bring me back. And eventually, I'd be standing exactly where I was standing and not having solved the problem at all, just having done a circle like this. Later on, interestingly, when I talked to Swamiji about mental breakdowns, he said, oh yes, he says, in the course of your many incarnations, there comes a point where the devotee, he put it slightly differently, sees the magnitude of the task in front of him and just decides to take a holiday and just retreat from reality for a while until you get yourself geared up to do it again. Been there, done that. But when I finally found Swamiji and Ananda and Master's Path, Kriya Yoga, all of this, what happened and has happened, you know, as recently as this morning, is that no matter how close I think I get to the edge, it just runs way out ahead of me. because the potential of it is literally infinite. So there's just no way that any of us can use up this path and get bored and decide we need another challenge if we're even slightly engaged in it. But the challenge of the spiritual life is, yes, it's a huge event to have the sufficiently good karma to be drawn to the path, even to make a deep commitment to the path. But the bigger challenge is to stay fresh in that commitment all the way through to the end. Sometimes I can tell this story without crying. I think I will try right now. A number of people who are still my very dear friends have been my very dear friends since we were all children at Ananda in our early 20s. We've been through quite a lot together. I remember one of my friends was remarking about some of the more chaotic elements of the 20-something tribe, which is many of you just sort of at Ananda, just doing unexpected, not always admirable things, and not always the brightest moves, but nonetheless, just sort of making things happen. And she was going kind of tisk, tisk. I said, "How short your memory is. Don't you remember being 20? Don't you remember what a mess we were in those early years of Ananda?" And just, that's what it's like when you have lots of energy and you're trying to figure it out and you don't know what to do and you're going in all directions. And I've always been in favor of going full out and hitting the wall than sitting safely in the center of the room for fear that you might. Because one of the things that we have to do if we're really going to stay strong on this path until the end, and the end to me is just not to quit. I mean, the end, of course, is self-realization. But if we don't quite make it, we have to not quit. That's what Arjuna says to Krishna. What if, Krishna, I renounce everything and I devote my life to the search for God and the end of my life comes and I haven't succeeded? And that's where Krishna answers, my devotee is never lost. But what he says after that is, it's not like you win or lose. We Americans are quite keen on the fact that the Super Bowl is on Sunday and we're going to watch the two football teams, as it happens, my team, because they live where our colony is, so we own them. I want our team to win because everybody's mood where I live will be better if we win. So that is my entire 100% commitment to our team. But the most ludicrous aspect of this is that at the end of the game, one team will be hysterically happy and the other team will be ludicrously depressed. Just ludicrously, as if their entire life has now failed because they've missed this one game. They got all the way to the top and ended up number two instead of number one. But a lot of times on the spiritual path, we get a strange idea like that, that if it's not going perfectly, then it must be going horribly. And what we don't understand is that success on the path is not to quit. And I was starting to say, I remember sitting with Nitai, you saw him in the film last night. Nitai has white hair. He didn't always have white hair. Once he had a lot of really rough red hair all over the place. And we were just talking and I noticed that he had white hair. The implications of that, I don't have white hair and this is God's given color to me. But I don't have white hair, but I'm the same age as Nitai. So if he's that old, then I'm probably that old too. And we weren't always. But the implications of that were so moving to me. I said, Nitai, we came young and we didn't give up. That's all. We just didn't give up. And I know what he's gone through and he knows what I've gone through, but we didn't quit. And sometimes on the spiritual path, it becomes that small. Because somehow we get this strange idea in our mind that if we're not succeeding in the way we think we should succeed, we're doing something wrong, that there's a different way to measure this. It's not so. Now, we can be more or less awake over the course of years. Sometimes people don't quit because they've gotten so sleepy they don't remember how to walk. You know, that's not necessarily the greatest victory, but even that is better than not giving up. But the ideal way to do it is the way Swamiji has done it. And I mean, even as we sit here, he's writing yet another book. And he's working too hard on writing that book. And he just doesn't know, and as he says, he doesn't know any other way to work except with 100% of every ounce of strength that he can muster for only one reason, and that is to serve his master. And what does it mean to serve his master? It means to help as many people as he possibly can get away from this ocean of suffering. I was speaking to someone recently about certain creative ideas that they have, very creative ideas for very interesting ways and original ways of serving master. You know, really good work that can be done, but not quite, you know, it's not a designed channel. This person's thinking of walking through. It's not just doing this job like this. It's, you know, it's bigger. It's out there. Oh, I hope that this will please master. I want to do it. I don't always know, you know, how master would do this. My answer was so simple. It seemed so obvious to me. Well, look at Swami. And one of the things that we all have to understand in the context of being disciples here, Swamiji, you know, in India, who is the guru is like the master is the master who's standing in front of you. It's not such a big issue in India. In America, partly because of the influence of SRF and the enormous importance of not trying to assert that Swami Kriyananda was trying to replace master, all this chaotic energy about who is really guiding us and how, has confused some very simple and obvious perceptions. You know, master, as Swamiji always speaks to us, he's the avatar, these are the avatars. It's very, very necessary that this work constantly refer back to master. And Swami explains it in a very simple way. He says, because if we dilute the focus in the first generation, he said, it will dilute so quickly that the power will be lost. So among many reasons why he constantly, we call master, master, and Swami, Swami, is because it's appropriate that we not dilute the focus. But even thinking of ourselves as master's disciples, what we're really trying to be is disciples, isn't that so? I mean, that's what defines our lives. That's what makes us different. In America, where I live, and having watched the evolution of interest in spiritual matters grow in the West from when we were really this tiny, tiny, weird little group of people to the day now where meditation and yoga is just everywhere where I live in California. In fact, you know, the YMCA, the problem is that everybody's teaching it. So we have to really still be able to say, because we're not doing anything remotely like anyone else is doing. But one of the really fundamental truths about our path is that we are disciples. And we are disciples of Paramahansa Yogananda and this line of masters. That's definitely a fact. But to be a disciple means that there is a guiding example. I mean, it means many things, but it also means there's a guiding example that we are not making up our spiritual life. Now, many people who become very sincere spiritually but do not become disciples have this sort of freedom to make up their spiritual life. I like this book. I like that technique. This seems like a good idea to me. I like this costume. Look at the pyramid on my head. And, you know, and in June I go here, and in July I go there, and in December I go here. And, you know, they're moving forward. It's everybody has their own way. They're shopping. They're dating. They're not ready to marry. Right? And, you know, that's not bad. If you marry too soon, you just get divorced. Where I live, you just get divorced. But once you become a disciple, in a very real sense, I mean, you've narrowed your options. You've given up your freedom. It's no longer up to you to say, I like this and I don't like that. We have chosen a plowed route, and that the attunement that we're looking for is coming from one source, and we know what that source is. I was so struck when, I think the circumstances are this, the answer is the point, but I think the question was, when there were some teenagers at Mount Washington, I think it might have even been Rinalini Mata. Oh no, excuse me, completely different question. Someone said to Master, "You say that you're talking about all religions, but you really only talk about Hinduism and Christianity. Why?" The person expected some, you know, intellectual explanation or something. Master replied, "It is the will of Babaji that I do it this way." And that was an extremely interesting statement. Of course, you think of Master as being an avatar, of being equal to anyone, which is also true. But even he, you know, I'm here at Babaji's request. Babaji and Christ are doing what they want to have done, and this is how they want to have it done. And he didn't feel the need to justify it any farther than that. For the disciple, that's the whole answer. It's the will of my master that it be done this way. Now, what we have to understand about that kind of discipleship, this is very subtle. And I'm going to come back to Swamiji in a moment. Maybe it was 2 years ago, 1 or 2 years ago, I don't remember. In America, Swamiji wrote the book, which many of you have read. It's called Yogananda for the World. And it is one more effort on the part of Swami Kriyananda to explain to Self-Realization Fellowship what they ought to be doing and why they ought to be doing it, and to make very clear, really for the historic record, you know, what Swamiji's consciousness is in relationship to serving Master, so that someday all of that confusion can go down. And as part of that, we were going to do what I lovingly call a direct marketing campaign with SRF members, which meant that we went down to the SRF churches in Los Angeles with picket signs announcing both the Yogananda for the World book and the new biography of Yogananda, and we passed out flyers. To say that this was not a universally popular idea, even among Ananda people, is putting it very mildly. And he always calls me when he wants something like that done. We've been doing these things since 1976. Because I'm that kind of a person. I think I'll do it just for the heck of it, you know. Because I'm just bold and I like brash gestures. But I spent a lot of time smoothing over other people's opinions that this wasn't such a good idea. Whether you think it's a good idea or not is irrelevant to this conversation, by saying, "Well, Swamiji asked me to do it." Now, on a certain level, that's a perfect answer, isn't it? He wants me to do it, and I'm such a good disciple, I'll just do it. But then, I was in certain circumstances. I was in seclusion, actually, but I still had email, and there was a lot of hoo-ha going on about whether we were going to do this and how we were going to do it. And a part of me suddenly realized what a cop-out that is. What a coward's answer. That I don't really have to take personal responsibility and actually understand this for myself. I can just always be a child. I can just always say, "Well, he told me to do it, so I'm doing it." Now, how much power is there in that? And how much real courage is there in the person having that attitude? And this is one of the things I was starting with. The most amazing thing about this path is if you just stay awake and stay on it, it just keeps getting more and more interesting. Just when you think you have everything all lined up, and your answers are so terrific, and you're explaining them for 10 years, then it occurs to you that you're just beginning. That's how I feel on this path. Every time I get somewhere, I feel like I'm just beginning, because all of a sudden it's revealed itself on another level. And you begin to understand how great saints and masters are not putting on a humble attitude. It's just the more expanded your vision gets, the more you realize how what infinity, even the edge of it, looks like, and how tiny we are in comparison. It's a stunningly liberating realization. You know, far from being discouraging, it's just stunningly liberating to realize just that we can just be a bubble in the sea here. But with that situation with SRF, I wrote Swamiji an apology letter. I said, I've supported you in these campaigns and in this attitude, really all these years, and I've always supported him. But I never really understood. I never really applied my consciousness in attunement with his to feel it from his point of view sufficiently to really understand. You see, if you just acquiesce, you're behaving properly, and I think that's better than mindless rebellion. But I recall that when Nitai was talking about teaching the children about spirituality, which is always a big question, are you indoctrinating them? Are you really teaching them? And he had such a perfect answer from his experience. He said, when we're talking to the children about spiritual matters, we're very attentive to two possibilities, mindless obedience or mindless rebellion. He said, because both are equally detrimental to the child's spiritual future. If they're just going along with you because you said it, they'll put it down as easily as they've picked it up. And I realize as devotees and as disciples, it's important for us to be cooperative, and it's important for us to allow the possibility that something is being asked of us that we don't understand. And it's possible to do that which you don't understand for 25 years without entirely understanding it. But you also must understand that eventually you must understand it. Because eventually it has to be so strong within you that nothing can take it down. In the film about Ananda, someone made the comment that Swami Kriyananda doesn't appear in that film as much as you might think he would. And it was interesting that when Swamiji watched it, the early cut that we're showing right at the moment, one of the things he said he particularly liked about it was that not only did he not appear in it that much, but he wasn't even referenced all that much. In other words, people didn't say, well, Swami did this and Swami did that, and we do this because Swami said we ought to, and we do that because Swami said we ought to. The truth is, the movie could have been made like that. It could have easily been made just referencing him in every respect. And one very astute outsider who watched the movie said she felt his consciousness all through the movie, which was very interesting given that the woman who made the comment had no experience, had never even met Swami or been to Ananda. But she could tell how he influenced. What I think she saw myself is that all of Krishna's soldiers look like Krishna. So she saw Swamiji's vibration and then noticed that same vibration everywhere, whatever she was identifying it, that it didn't have to be referenced. Because even though we may start our discipleship because Swami said so, we must end up because this is my life. And so people even in the movie took credit for things that had actually been Swamiji's decision without even realizing it. And I was involved in that movie word by word for a great deal of it. I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind. No, that's not entirely true. I did correct a few places where the way cooperation with him was expressed was not magnetic. It sounded mindless. It didn't sound magnetic. But mostly it never occurred to me, because when I heard people declaring, you know, what their reality was in relation to this path, in relation to Master's work, in relation to communities, they were just telling the truth as they know it. And sure, it started from the fact that we had the incredible good karma to have him point out to us which way was forward. But then we walked. And that's how we get there. And where I was starting with all of this, when I was saying I was talking to my friend who has very creative work and was sort of wondering how to proceed, He said, what we have when we're part of Ananda, which is so unusual, we have the masters. And it's not only that we have Swamiji who was with Master, but the definition of Swami's incarnation is that he is a disciple. So he has lived exactly the life that we're trying to live. You see how perfect that is? And if we can enter into that with the right spirit, and, you know, not all of us have his talent. Well, don't be absurd. None of us have his talents or anything remotely like it, you know? But we can all have his dedication to serving Master and the characteristic way in which he does it, which is, well, he's so courageous. He's so creative. He's so fearless in the way he goes about it. He's so willing to make mistakes, to just try things out in totally public ways. There was an event that happened about 25 years ago, and Swamiji made all these enormous public declarations about the future of his life and the future of Ananda, and it was even published in national magazines with pictures and everything. And before those magazines were published, the whole initiative had fallen to pieces in the most just, well, he used the word, "This could be quite embarrassing if I chose to be embarrassed," was his word. And then he just said, "But I choose not to be." Because far better to have gone forward with the power that's in you and do your best out of sincere belief than to never have the courage to try. And Swamiji has been many things, but courageous is certainly one of them. I mean, I look at this project here, which I know all of you are looking at, and last night I saw Roby over there with those pipes. This morning I saw Roby over there with those pipes. I think the day before I saw Roby over there with those pipes. Either he's doing a really long project or he's doing the same project over and over. I'm not really sure which one it is, and I don't really want to know. I don't really want to know. And just yesterday in my room in the apartment, I know what this is. The water's run out. There's no water in here. It didn't even occur to me to say anything to anyone. I just thought, well, you know, sometimes you have water, sometimes you don't have water. You know, this is just the way things go. At Ananda Village, it was absolutely dependable. The larger the number of guests we had, the more certainty we would run out of water, the pump would break, and just everything. The more people were depending on all of our facilities, the more certain it would, there would be a total disaster. Always. It was just like clockwork, right? In the middle, oh yes, now the water system is blown up, and the equivalent of Roby, whoever it was often Ananta or someone, you know, they'd be up all night fixing it. It happens in Assisi, everywhere. What we're doing is really impossible. And this project is, I think even among impossible projects, this one stands out. This is way. The only thing that makes it a little less so is that it's not the first impossible project. And it's very easy for us to lose sight of what we're doing here, and very easy for us to lose sight of what Swamiji has shown us about how we do things and where our growth comes from. I mean, you look at what Swami is now, and he's always been the same. The first day I met him, he was the same. He presented himself differently. And of course, he had a younger body, but he was always the same. Just the what you sense of him. But what you see is the fruit of discipleship. What you see is not, I mean, of course, it's good karma, but what you see is a person who has walked a little farther on exactly the same path we're walking. And what we see in him is the absolute promise of where this path will take us if we don't quit. And what keeps us from quitting is that we're creative and have fun. You know, you always do that, which is fun. It's just as simple as that. If it's fun, you do it. That's why I asked Swamiji once, you know, I was looking for a big intellectual answer. "Sir, what is the mission of Ananda?" People have been asking me, this is like 1973, "What is the mission of Ananda, sir?" "To have fun," He said like that. The whole room just laughed and laughed and then waited for his real answer. And so then he said, but you have to understand what I mean by having fun. He said, it's to experience Divine Mother within yourself and then to share that joy with everyone. And that is the purpose of Ananda. Now, it's really easy to think that some of the things we're doing now are not any fun. We're in opposition to each other a lot of the time. People, how did someone say, it's the wrong person in the right job for them. Someone once came to me. I've been in the position I've been in the Palo Alto community for like 27 years, I think. Unbelievable. And it was not a natural position for me. Swamiji's putting me back into my natural life, which is to just lecture and write. But I've had to operate this community, and I'm the big public face of that community, but the reason it succeeded is my husband, who's not even here with me, because he really makes it happen, and then I tell everyone about it, so they get the impression that I'm doing it, but he's actually the one who's doing it. So it's not like, that's not such a natural thing for me to be responsible in that way. And this man came to me, poor fellow, and he really wanted me to know. I don't find you very inspiring, he said to me. I said, oh my God, that must be terrible. I talk all the time. You know, and you're here and you're always having to listen to me. He just looked like that. So then he went to his next item of the agenda, which was an extremely valid criticism of something really inept that I had done. And I answered by saying, do you think if I had learned how to do this job properly, I would still be doing it? Like, what are the chances? I think, all considered, that I'm really glad I haven't made more terrible mistakes than that. You know, and at the end of it, of course, we worked it out and he became friends, and I don't think he suffered as much after that. But do you think that if we could do this easily and well, we would still be bothering to do it? What would be the, what possible benefit would there be for us in that? You know, when you become a disciple, everything turns over. Everything turns over. The Gita says that. What's day to the worldly man is night for the devotee. What's day for the devotee is night for the worldly man. Oh, we can all just quote this. We can say it. Some of you might even know the number in the Gita where it is. But when it actually happens to us, and this is going wrong, and that's going wrong, and this is a problem, and I feel this, and I want this, and I'm not getting that, and God has taken an unwelcome interest in my spiritual growth, and I want to get my life back. Stop. You know, Swamiji often repeats to us stories of difficulties that he's been through, what he's had to face, how hard it's been for him, how much opposition there was. You know, and you think, why is he saying this? And I've even had people say, he should be more positive. Okay. I work backwards. If Swamiji is doing it, why is he doing it? And, you know, hearing the same things over and over again, as many of us have, when you finally realize what he'd been trying to tell you, you're so grateful that he didn't stop saying it. You know? The purpose of the spiritual path is to become free. It's not to feel good as you go along. It's not to have things easy. The ego says good equals pleasurable and easy. You know, bad equals they're making it hard for me, right? And the joy of Ananda, just the exquisiteness of Ananda is they often are making it hard for you. They often are incompetent. They often are, oh dear, also getting a chance to grow spiritually, rats, you know? There was a person in the community that I live in now, very difficult test for people for a while when they lived there. They're a very difficult test. And someone came to me and demanded I do something. I said, here's an idea. Let's take that person out into the center of the community and shoot them. How's that? We'll execute them, and then we won't have to bother with them anymore. You know? alternative to that, I think we're just going to have to learn to get along. Because if that person is sincere and is trying to grow, and even if their best from your point of view, is terrible. We're all in this together. That's the other part of discipleship, is it's really nice to think that the only one we get is Master, and then we also get Swami, but we also get each other. And it's not a small part of it. It's a multifold reality, having each other. On one hand, you know, the depth of friendship and love that you can find with each other is unprecedented. You don't get it with your own blood relatives. You know, your own blood relatives are your relatives because your bodies are related. But these people, us, we've had countless bodies and we're still like this. It has nothing to do with anything ephemeral. We have collectively committed to attain self-realization, to help each other attain it, and to help do Master's mission, not just this time, but many times. Swami has the book about when he was, Master was William and he was Henry. I'm sure we were there. He talks about when Master was Arjuna and Krishna. I mean, we've been on this path for a really long time, maybe little tiny people in it, maybe bigger roles, maybe our names are in a history book somewhere. We've been doing this for a very, very long time. And we've been doing it together. And as Swamiji said, I remember once a man developed an infatuation with a certain woman, and so it was a terrible idea for them to be together. It was really a bad idea. And the man said, well, why do I feel such attachment to her? Swamiji said, look long enough into the eyes of anyone in this community and you will discover that you have a deep soul connection. He said, because everybody in this spiritual family has a deep soul connection to each other. He said, we've been all in all to one another. Isn't that a beautiful way to put it? Just we've been everything to each other. You know, we have to live according to the dharma of whatever body and circumstance we're in now. And so the mere fact that we have those connections to each other does not in itself dictate how those connections will express. But in Swami's beautiful way, he acknowledges the truth of our feelings, and then we decide what to do with them in terms of dharma. But that's just such a... How many people in the world have no friends? One friend. Just one person. And we can go anywhere on this planet. And many of you have been doing exactly that. You've been gypsying from community to community and just finding everywhere you go. That's all part of discipleship, is that we have this commitment to God, we have a commitment to Guru, we have a commitment to Swamiji, we have a commitment to each other. Now, did anybody say this would be easy? No. But easy is so boring, really, really boring. My father, toward the end of his life, bless his dear soul, he was a good man. He lacked a certain amount of courage, a certain amount of personal courage. He was a good man. And my mother was ill for a long time, and he got a little tired. And at a certain point, I was trying to persuade him of something that at the time seemed important. I don't know what it was now. And I said to him, Daddy, don't you want to grow? And he looked at me and said, no. Just like that, no. And I realized that he didn't have any more courage left. Life had been the last few years of his life with my mother's illness had been a little too hard, and he was just going to hunker down and make it through, which he did, actually. He just kind of let a little age-related dementia set in, and he just got a little childlike, you know, for a couple of years there. And I felt perfectly fine. I said, oh, Daddy's taking a holiday. He's just had it with self-expansion, and he's just going to take a little holiday. My uncle, his older brother, who lived another 10 years, he had the habit, my father went sweet when his mind he just went into his heart and got very sweet. Actually, much sweeter than he'd been for a long time. My uncle, his brother, went angry. He'd always prided himself on being the smartest man in the room, and he was very fond of saying what idiots everyone else was. So when his mind began to go, it went, unfortunately, into that groove. And he would tell me repeatedly about these incidences, you know, just like sometimes people do in that state, repeatedly about, you know, when so-and-so had done such a stupid thing and he knew better and no one had listened and like this. And After it had calmed down for about the 15th time, I said, Uncle Ted, you know, do you like just going over and over again the things that you're angry about? Oh, yes. He said like that. And it was just like my father. I thought, whoa, I'm just going to walk away from this. Okay, if you want to, that's where your mind is stuck now. So that's what you're going to do. You know? We have many, many choices on the spiritual path, on the path of life. And one of the things that gives us power on this path is each other, and gives us one of the secrets of why you see such extraordinary spiritual light in the eyes of Ananda devotees is because we have each other. And because of the way Swamiji has taught us and exemplified for us how we deal with each other. I have been repeatedly, in this most recent adventure of the direct marketing to Self-Realization Fellowship for Swami's book, was a perfect example of that. And the other, even greater example was about 10 years earlier, in the middle of our lawsuits, when we also went down to the SRF convocation to tell all the SRF members that their organization was spending millions of dollars suing us. That was also, not everyone at Ananda thought that was a really good idea. Some people thought that was about the worst idea they had ever heard. So people were calling Swamiji all the time, you know, we can't do this, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. Swami had the most brilliant phrase. I love it. I understand why you feel that way. That's what he said to people. And he really did understand why they felt that way. And he never said they were right or that they were wrong. He just said, I understand why you feel that way. And then he was their friend. And he could say to opposite sides of the same question, I understand why you feel that way. And given, you know, the whole incarnations that got them right to this point, it was inevitable that they would feel that way. And I would come, or someone else would come from the other side. We get exactly the same, just total embracing of our consciousness, without in any way committing himself to our delusion. He would commit himself to our self-realization. And you know, the extent to which I have not been utterly incompetent in what I've been doing for the last 25 years is because every time I get caught, I meditate on that. How does Swamiji manage to make every single one of us feel loved, respected, accepted, worthwhile, even when two people have exactly opposite points of view and are totally at loggerheads with each other, both of them feel that Swami is completely supportive? And I don't mean that he's manipulating in any way, because somehow once that's in place, everything else somehow manages to work its way out. Sometimes you get your way, sometimes you don't. Sometimes all that's required is if we can get outside of ourselves enough to just recognize that I understand why you feel that way. And then we don't have to go on and on and on with that. We just go where we're going. This is discipleship as Swamiji has lived it. And one of the reasons he talks to us a great deal about what happened to him when he was expelled from SRF and the way he was treated is he never wants us to go there, ever. He never wants anything to become more important than our relationship with one another. Master called it self-realization, which is obvious. We like that one. Fellowship. It's actually the word oxymoronic, isn't it? How can you be self-realized, which is you have to individually make love to God, it's only you, and be in fellowship? But that's part of the uniqueness of our path. And then the last thing that we, not the last, but another thing that we really have to realize is that we have a really serious job to do. And doing this job is not at all separate from our discipleship or our self-realization. And that's where Swamiji's example comes again. He's, almost 87? God knows he's written a lot of books. Anybody's description of whether or not this man has had a productive life, it's pretty easy to say that he already has. But he's still breathing and he's still on this earth. And what other reason does a disciple have for living except to serve his guru? And see, this is where our spiritual path gets really different than a path that doesn't have a master. And we are disciples of a guy who really does things in the world. You know, he doesn't just appear and sit under a tree and then have people kind of, you know, come around him, and then he sits there in silence and meditates for 40 years and occasionally says something. I mean, Ramana Maharshi was a great yogi, but essentially that's what he did. He just showed up and started meditating and never stopped, and had just no relationship to that. Sri Yukteswar had very little relationship to that. Remember, Master came back and said, you know, I would like to buy you a new carpet. Sri Yukteswar's response was, that's your world. Just like that. It has nothing to do with me. But even though we have Sri Yukteswar to think longingly about, this is the guy we're following. And that's our prototype. And that's what Swamiji says. I was 22 years old. And I was there at the garden party when Master declared the importance of these communities. And Swami tells us these things. I've heard them more than you have, but you've all heard them a lot by now. There were 800 people there. And he says all the disciples were there. All of Master's disciples were there. I was the only one who heard him. And he spoke it to everyone, but Swami heard him. And he said, I vowed I would do my utmost. And Swami has succeeded. But Swami didn't say, I'll succeed. He said, I vowed I would do my utmost. And for a disciple, that's all that matters. Yes, he has succeeded beyond imagination of expectancy. It's very important also to realize, you see, Swamiji was thrown out of SRF when he was 36. He'd been in SRF for 14 years. He had, what did he say, $500 in his wallet? Maybe a little less than that. He's a grown man. He's been on his own for a very long time. His parents put him in the back seat of their car and drive him from New York to California, and he's living in the bedroom of his parents' house. He has no income. He's been exiled from all his friends. The entire purpose and meaning of his life has been pulled out from under him. He had nothing, absolutely nothing. Everything that's happened since was created from nothing. You know, it's easy when you see it to think that some other force did it, but it was done out of his determination as a discipleship to serve his guru. That's what it means to be a disciple. Swamiji is the perfect disciple. When I wrote this in my book about him, at one point I said, we went to New York, and we were visiting some spiritual teacher who was a flash in the pan, who was a real devotee, but just a flash in the pan. She was just there, and now she's left the planet and disappeared from view. There were 800 people in the room, and everybody was crowding around, and it was a woman, and she allowed the accoutrements of being a spiritual leader to be a really big part of who she was. And jokingly, I said to Swamiji afterwards, I said, Swamiji, if you would just declare yourself omnipotent and let us put a white umbrella over your head, we could really get Ananda going. You know, just like, come on, sir, don't be a sloucher on this. Let's make it happen. He said, there are a lot of gurus. He said, what the world needs now is examples of true disciples. And I really thought about that a lot. Because he didn't say one way or another what he had to offer us, what his relationship to us was, or anything. He said, what the world needs now is examples of true disciples. And he wasn't just talking about himself. He was telling us what our path is, which is to serve a reality greater than ourselves in accordance with how that spiritual authority has defined for us what we need to do. Then we have to own it. We can't just labor away here because, well, Swami wants this community, so we'll make this community. You know, Swami wants this. Even the little world I live, the words I just hate to hear is, Asha wants this. No, 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 please, don't ever do that. I'm very, very protective of how my name is used. Because it's just like, then you don't have to think about it anymore. You know, mindless acquiescence or equally mindless rebellion. Swami wants it this way. Well, yes, Swamiji may in fact have suggested, but Swami doesn't want anything except our self-realization. If it's a true idea, then we should see the truth of it. And if the origin of that true idea was Swamiji, well, that would mean we ought to at least consider whether it's true. But it's the truth of it, not that he wants it. And of course, it's lovely in your heart to try to please someone that you love. That's a fundamental part of learning to be a generous human being. But if you're just doing it to please someone that you love, sooner or later that house of cards just crashes down. You start doing it because you love, but you end up doing it because you understand that this is my reality and my truth. You know, discipleship is pretty much like marriage, only better. But people spend thousands of dollars on their weddings, and in the course of the years, David and I have presided at quite a number of weddings, and we've, you know, done the wedding so that we were doing the vows at the precise astrological moment, like this, you know. And so that I had to time my remarks just to be finished right on the nose like that. We've done weddings where, the parents gave thousands of dollars at the country club, and we have the matchbooks with their name on it and the napkins and the whole things. And, you know, we've stood in the middle of a field with the wind blowing like this. And I've never yet been to a wedding that actually created a marriage. You know, they succeed and fail pretty much randomly without any consistent pattern that I've seen for any of those things, including the precise astrological moment, which is what I tell people when the precise astrological moment is 11:35 at night or 2:15 a.m. or something like that. Because all you've done when you take your vow is declare what you're going to do with the rest of your life. But the rest of your life follows right after. And so we have to really understand that if we want to be disciples, we have to do it every day, every minute. We have to be really, really attentive to mindless acquiescence or mindless rebellion. We have to be really, really careful. Every time we are making decisions that are not consistent with the decisions that Swami Kriyananda has made throughout his whole life, because that's how we get there from here. You know, it's our path. It's the most amazing thing to contemplate. I love this fact. You know, we know that all of these masters attained self-realization. And we know that their understanding of our life experience, you know, they understand our life experience, but it's really strange for me to think because they actually lived through it. You know, that at some point, Master was a human being, you know, with an overwhelming desire to eat Snickers candy bars or whatever it might have been. Because if they came from wherever it is when we begin, Master said, I still don't exactly know how to think about this. Master said he remembered being a diamond, remembered back to the point of being a diamond. So I came to Swami once commissioned with the question, how long does it take to stop being a diamond? How does a diamond evolve? And what do you become next? An emerald, a sapphire, a redwood tree? You know, what happens? Swami looked at me and he said, that's a really stupid question. I said, I thought it was interesting. He said, I don't. Just like that. And then, because whenever he rejects something entirely, he usually rethinks it. He just turned and he said, very simply, compared to eternity, all other sense of time is just an instant like that. So when we think of the evolution from a diamond, it appears so massive to us, but compared to eternity, it's nothing. And then after that, he wouldn't go there because it was just intellectual curiosity. But the point is, if he remembers back to being a diamond, then it means he walked right through what we're walking through. He went right through it all. So any sense of embarrassment or unworthiness or don't want to trouble Master with this little thing that we're dealing with, he stood here, exactly here. He must have. I mean, maybe there were no Snicker bars in the yoga that he was in, but whatever the vibration of that temptation, he had to transcend it. So has Swami. And so whatever reality we're looking at now, it came from the same seed. And the more powerfully we just hold that thought in our mind, you know, I will be a great and noble spiritual tree because the seed of that is within me, and the way to get from here to there is like this. That's just so depressing on one hand that we're actually doing exactly what we should be doing, and this is it, you know. But if you have a little seed, it has to go through every stage. I don't do much gardening, but I got involved with this hyacinth that someone gave me. It's a little hyacinth bulb, and it's in water. And the little, you can see, it's in clear glass, and you can see the little roots coming down below, and you can see the little green guy coming up at the top. And I mean, he started just this sort of ugly blob. And now he's made, and he'll blossom while I'm gone, but he's made all these little roots, and every day there were a few more of them, and at the same time there was a little more of the green, and I don't know, something about that little guy. He was just doing it. He was so committed to being a hyacinth, and he was just going to work so hard at it. And I thought, you know, that's me. That's all of us. You know, we're just there. We're putting our little roots down, and we're putting our little green shoot up, and there's just no way to get from where he is to what he's going to be, except by the method he's using. And that's how he got there. That's how they all got there. That's how we got there. And discipleship is the power. That's the pull, you know. Until then, you're just wandering around. But once you have a discipleship relationship, you know where you're going. And all you have to do then is not quit, which is my prayer for everyone.